Media under attack. Journalists face increasing threats in the field and online from disinformation and censorship. So what can be done to protect the free flow of news and information? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Mohammed Jamjoum. The internet is a place for the free flow of information, as well as attempts to control and suppress it. This year's UN World Press Freedom Day is highlighting threats to the media, especially online. Russia's war on Ukraine is a major example. The Committee to Protect Journalists says at least 7 media workers have died in the field since the invasion began in February. The media has become the battleground for competing narratives on the conflict. Britain's government has accused Russia of running a so-called troll factory in St. Petersburg to spread disinformation and lies on the internet. And the UN says online attacks on journalists and information are eroding public trust. This year's World Press Freedom Index by the NGO Reporters Without Borders issued warnings on how propaganda and unregulated social media are fueling divisions within and between countries. Examples include Russia's propaganda campaigns before its invasion of Ukraine. The United States, France, and Poland, the report says, are facing some of the worst media polarization due to misinformation and opinion-driven media. The civil society organization Forum of Information and Democracy wants countries to adopt legal frameworks and systems to protect information online. The European Union has proposed laws to limit lawsuits designed to silence journalists and human rights advocates. They would give courts more power to dismiss cases if they're found to be abusive or unjustified. The EU criticized some governments and businesses for using defamation proceedings as a form of harassment.
The role of journalists and those that keep power in check is tremendous. The package that we propose today, a directive and a recommendation to member states, will ensure that they can exercise this role. In some, but not all, member states, defamation is still a criminal offence that carries a prison sentence. Member states are therefore encouraged to abolish prison sentences for defamation cases. They should favour the use of administrative or civil law instead of criminal law for such cases.
All right, let's go ahead and bring in our guests. Rebecca Vincent is Director of Operations and Campaigns at Reporters Without Borders. She joins us from London. Joining us from Vinnytsia in Ukraine is Romeo Kokryatsky. He's Managing Editor at the New Voice of Ukraine. Also joining us from London is Tim Squirrel. He is Head of Communications and Editorial at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. A very warm welcome to you all, and thanks so much for joining us today on Inside Story. Rebecca, let me start with you today. Where does the state of press freedom worldwide stand right now?
Unfortunately, we've reached another World Press Freedom Day where the state of press freedom around the world has gotten worse. This year, a record total of 28 countries have dipped into our worst category of the index, indicating that their country situation for press freedom is very bad. We've highlighted a number of trends in the analysis that comes out with our index, but the overarching theme of this year really being that we've entered a new era of polarization. And so we've looked at how polarization both within countries and between countries has impacted the state of media freedom around the world, and the impact has indeed been significant.
Romeo, just how difficult and dangerous are things right now for Ukrainian journalists? And also, how tough is it to counter disinformation and propaganda and to make sure that accurate reporting is getting out?
It's not. I would say that over the past 8 years, Ukrainians have become masters of countering Russian disinformation. The escalation of propaganda during the war is to be expected, but I think that we have developed a media ecosphere that is very resistant to Russian disinformation. And I think now, finally, we've been able to start exporting that kind of resistant ecosphere to the rest of the world, because Russian disinformation is, I think, as everyone here knows, incredibly pernicious and has basically infiltrated nearly every aspect of the modern narratives that we have. As for the dangers of reporting, I mean, it is a war zone. A lot of cities are, however, safe. Reporting from Lviv does not nearly carry the same risks as reporting from occupied Kherson, for example. And for those who are living in occupied territory, I mean, they are incredibly brave, and I am incredibly grateful for the work that they're doing. But as these areas stay under occupation for longer, it will only grow more and more dangerous for the journalists working in Russian-occupied areas, and of course for journalists that go and visit the front lines. But generally, I would say most journalists are in relatively safe cities, and we, for now, have about the same level of security we did before the war, barring the occasional missile strike.
Tim, you heard Romeo there talk about the pernicious effects of Russian propaganda and disinformation. I saw you nodding along, so I want to get your reaction. But also I want to talk to you about the fact that the British government is now saying that Russian internet trolls based in St. Petersburg are targeting world leaders online, that they're spreading support for Putin's invasion of Ukraine. You know, initially, many had considered that Russia was losing the information war when it came to propaganda about Ukraine. Is that changing at this point?
So there's a few things to tease out here. I don't necessarily share the same kind of optimism of Romeo around the resilience of the information sphere outside of Ukraine. We've certainly seen real concerted attempts from pro-Kremlin forces to push their narratives elsewhere, on social media, in mainstream media, in various other spaces. So, for example, in the aftermath of the Bucha atrocities, when they came out, ISD did a study, looked at the 200 sort of posts which were most shared across Facebook in 20 different countries, and found that while a minority of them, about 55, were disputing the kind of true account of what happened in Bucha, they were more shared than the other 145 combined. And so there's still quite a lot that social media platforms and tech companies need to do to try to clean up the information ecosystem and make it more resilient to the kinds of narratives and propaganda that are coming out of the Kremlin. In terms of your second question around whether we or the West are winning the information war, I think it's a complex picture. So obviously around the beginning of the war, you had a lot of people say Zelensky in particular was doing extremely well, and Ukraine more broadly. That was taken as quite a Western-oriented view. And if you look at some of the studies coming out of ISD and elsewhere, you can see that there are real inroads being made in a lot of non-Anglosphere communities by the Kremlin. So, for example, RT in Arabic is doing extremely well. If you look in a number of other countries, you can see this across the social media landscape as well. So while it may be the case that in the West they're doing reasonably well, Russia is attempting to push its narratives and win the information war on a number of different fronts, and we can't afford to let our guard down there.
Romeo, let me also ask you about what the British government is saying, because they've also alerted international partners that they're going to work closely with allies and media platforms in order to undermine Russian information operations. From your perspective, what are the steps that need to be taken in order to counter this? And what can be done to protect the free flow of news and information?
I think one of the biggest tools that the kind of liberal democratic world has to counter this disinformation, specifically on social media, is the fact that social media companies are based in liberal democracies. They are accepting, of course, for the Chinese social media companies, they're mostly based out of Silicon Valley or somewhere else in the United States. And that means that they must respond to regulatory pressure. They must respond to policymakers. They must respond to legislation. The greatest tool that we have in order to really ensure that social media companies clean up their act, that they stop giving a platform to obvious conspiracy mongers, obvious peddlers of disinformation, is to mandate them in some way. And I'm not a policy expert. Don't take my word as gospel, but there must be a real conversation about a legislative approach or regulatory framework that can be applied to these social media platforms that will somehow constrain the operation, especially of bots, because a lot of this disinformation is not being shared organically. It is first boosted to an insane degree by bot networks. And then once that initial engagement has been registered by the algorithms, only then does it begin to get traction organically and spread from there. So there has to be something to constrain the activity of these bots. Often these are networks, as we know in Russia, these are networks funded and operated by state actors. And taking anything less than a regulatory or legislative approach to that problem is not going to fix it. You can't rely on the tech companies themselves, the social media platforms themselves, to self-regulate, because first, their incentives are not there to do so. And secondly, they are not state actors and they don't really have the resources necessary to counter a state working on a disinformation direction on their own.
Rebecca, we were speaking before about the 2022 edition of the Reporters Without Borders World Press Freedom Index. And one of the issues that that highlights is what it calls the disastrous effect of news and information chaos. So I want to ask you, what is the impact of a globalized and unregulated online information space that encourages fake news and propaganda? And how bad is it all getting?
Well, that, again, is one of the major themes that we highlighted in the index, is the impact of all of this on the state of press freedom around the world. So when we talk about polarization, we mean exactly that, the sort of the impact of disinformation proliferating on social media, but also outright propaganda. And that's not just a matter of internet trolling. That can be actually done on official media channels. And so this year, we have seen that within countries, including our own democracy. So I know we're mostly talking about Russia at the moment, but it's worth noting that part of the trend is even within our democracies, the proliferation of opinion media, the sort of Fox Newsification of media, is also contributing to this chaos. And then, of course, the propaganda wars of authoritarian states, including Russia, against democracies. It's all creating a lot of tension when it comes to global press freedom. So it's worth noting that, of course, while the Ukraine conflict was preceded by an information war, this is not a new phenomenon. This has been building for years when it comes to Russia, and it's not only Russia. We've pointed for a number of years to concerns with China. For example, Reporters Without Borders published a landmark report just in December, really examining the spread of China's model of information control, which China is now trying to proliferate throughout the region and in fact internationally as well. It's not just a Russia problem, it's broader than we think. At Reporters Without Borders, we do think that there needs to be greater responsibility of the platforms. What that looks like, it has to be done in a way that protects press freedom and freedom of information at the core. We've engaged in advocacy around the European DSA, for example, which we think currently looks like a good model of how this could be accomplished. Here in London, I'm watching carefully what the UK government is doing with the online safety bill. We've got a few concerns, I have to say, but it's clear that this space does need some regulation.
So, Tim, you heard Rebecca there talk about the fact that these online spaces, from her vantage point, need more regulation. I also heard Romeo talk about that there should be frameworks put in place to help safeguard information that's out there. I want to ask you, you know, there's growing calls for countries to adopt legal frameworks and systems to protect information online, to counter disinformation. Of course, one example Rebecca mentioned, the DSA with the EU. But do you think that we're going to see more of this? Is this trend going to continue? Are there countries out there that are going to be setting up systems or passing legislation in order to do this?
Well, it's absolutely necessary for these kinds of regulatory frameworks to be introduced. And I just want to give a quick word about what they need to look like, as well as the fact that they need to exist. Because up until now, we've both relied upon platforms to moderate themselves and also taken a really piecemeal approach to content moderation, which looks at specific pieces of content or types of content and tries to remove them, rather than examining the underlying business models of the companies, rather than looking at how their own models and how their own algorithms can encourage the kinds of problems that we're seeing. So what we really need is a systemic approach which allows us, for example, as researchers, to access data, to encourage rigorous levels of transparency so that we can see just how big the problems are and how they are functioning. Because because all this data shouldn't be in-house at tech companies. It should be available for scrutiny by those who are qualified to look at it. And so we need to make sure that these regulatory frameworks enshrine that in law. And I really do hope that in addition to the DSA, in addition to the Online Safety Bill, that other countries with clout and with large numbers of users in them start to adopt these, because the power that they have is directly proportional to how much of the market of a tech company is regulated. So the DSA in Europe means much more, for example, than the Online Safety Bill in the UK. If the US were to introduce similar kinds of legislation, that would have much more power still, partly because of these companies being based primarily in Silicon Valley. And then, I guess, if I may, a word about TikTok, which is a bit of a problem because of the fact that it is Chinese owned. It doesn't have the same kinds of regulation or accessibility as nearly any other platform. It's the most opaque. You basically have to do any kind of research on it manually. We have no conception of the scale of the problem on there, but the manual qualitative research that we have done shows that there are huge amounts of propaganda being pumped onto the platform from state actors and non-state actors alike. Margarita Simonian, the editor of Russia Today, or RT, has an extremely popular account on there, even with RT and Sputnik being banned. It's important to note that this platform in particular has become a massive new vector for disinformation, and we really need to do something about that.
Romeo, it looked to me like you were reacting to some of what Tim was saying. Did you want to jump in?
No, I just wanted to mention that, yes, as Tim said, I think taking this individualized approach to creating regulatory frameworks for these social media platforms. I mean, Twitter and Facebook don't work alike. TikTok and Instagram don't work alike. And there is no one size fits all framework you can place on all these platforms and say, well, the problem is solved. You do have to approach them individually based on how the platform operates. And I think this is an incredibly important insight to remember when we consider kind of what the future of digital communication is going to look like. And now that we have matured enough to encounter these massive, massive information problems.
Rebecca, so in April, the European Commission announced that it wants to see the EU adopt a law to protect journalists and civil rights activists from lawsuits aimed at censoring them. But in order to take effect, this proposal is going to need approval from EU member countries and from lawmakers in the European Parliament. First and foremost, do you think that this is going to happen? And secondly, how significant would it be if it does?
You'd have to scrutinize the bill in question, but in principle, of course, there is a need for greater protections, in particular for journalists online. And I don't know if that particular bill is focused just on the sort of disinformation side, or if it possibly might extend to, for example, covering SLAP, strategic lawsuits against public participation, because I know there's been a lot of advocacy towards securing protections against SLAPs, particularly that target journalists at the EU level. From my perspective, that would be a positive thing. But again, we have to see what is tabled and to assess indeed what support it has, and if that might then be passable not only at the European level, but possibly replicable elsewhere.
Rebecca, I also want to ask you, from your vantage point, how much better equipped are fact-checking organizations now at dealing with disinformation, whether it's surrounding the war in Ukraine, whether it's surrounding the pandemic, other propaganda efforts? Just how much better have fact-checkers online gotten at countering propaganda and disinformation?
Well, from Reporters Without Borders side, we haven't actually focused on fact-checking initiatives because our press freedom mandate means that we focus on journalism. And frankly, if something has not been fact-checked, it is not professional journalism. We have worked instead to develop the Journalism Trust Initiative, which is essentially a whitelisting exercise. We've developed a standard initially at the European level, but which we're now working to roll out more globally, that looks to sort of encourage and incentivize journalism that has gone through a rigorous check to show that it is about professional ethical standards of journalism. So we feel strongly that it shouldn't be about the content, but about the process, because then you address the content issues that arise. But if you only address content as fact-checking initiatives do, that is only addressing the symptom and not the disease.
Tim, the UN has said that online attacks on journalists and information are eroding trust. From your vantage point, how bad are things getting?
I think that's extremely important to note, because fact-checking is one thing, and so is stopping frivolous or overly litigious lawsuits. But we have to address the root cause of this, which is, at least to some degree, that trust in journalism, trust in democratic institutions, trust in electoral processes is really being eroded on a systematic level by a variety of actors. And the demand side of disinformation isn't being addressed either. So it's not just that people are being supplied a range of different narratives from a range of different bad actors. It's also that they are looking for that kind of information because in many ways, a lot of things in the world feel like they're getting worse. People feel like they can't trust authorities. And so consequently, they end up going looking for things which make totalizing conclusions about the world, which see it in black and white terms, which often appeal to conspiracy theories, because those give them more satisfying explanations than many of the things, many of the real mechanisms which underpin the way the world works. And so that's deeply problematic. And we know that they're many regimes and also many governments are in, and political parties in states are engaging in these sorts of campaigns to undermine trust. We saw it during the Trump years in the US. We see it with Russia right now. We see it with, for example, North African regimes like the Eritrean regime. We see it in Eastern Europe with Hungary or Central Europe, rather. And that's deeply problematic. So I think we are in a really quite dire state right now with respect to the amount of trust that we place in journalists and the amount of attacks that happen in the online space, as well as offline, as well as the sort of prosecutions and other kinds of lawsuits.
Romeo, do you think we're at a moment where we'll see a drive by more members of the international community to actually strengthen protections for journalists and for journalism?
Unfortunately, I can't really say that I'm optimistic. In this sense, there has been a consistent trend over the past few years in basically the opposite direction. There has been a huge movement which is based around the kind of concept of free speech, or at least that's the rhetoric that they use. And you saw some of this with when billionaire Elon Musk said he was going to buy Twitter and bring free speech back. But that rhetoric actually serves to obscure the actual practical effects of what these so-called free speech policies would bring, which would be an end to moderation or incredibly hands-off moderation, which in turn will only intensify attacks, intensify dogpiling, intensify smears, and further erode trust in any kind of institution, including journalistic ones. So unless governments really take a long-term and kind of layered or nuanced look at the situation instead of simply bowing to the rhetoric, oh, we need more free speech, we need less regulation, they're controlling your speech. Unless that kind of rhetoric is ignored and the question is probed further by policymakers, then I don't see that situation improving, especially when it has such, you know, wide support from very influential individuals in the public sphere.
Rebecca, how much have surveillance and hacking compromised journalists of late? And not just journalists, but also their sources and whistleblowers. How much more dangerous has it gotten for them all?
It has certainly increased, I think, tensions. It sometimes can lead to self-censorship if somebody feels very ill at ease in investigating, for example, certain risky topics or individuals. It's also worth mentioning the impact immediately that all of this has on the safety of journalists. In parallel to trolling, this active sort of abuse and threats and these, you know, vast pylons that can happen very easily towards journalists, and in particular, often disproportionately targeting women journalists, too often now can translate into real life manifestation of such threats and sometimes violent acts. And so in our broader work and in the sort of more classic areas of press freedom, such as safety of journalists, this is also having a massive impact as well. It's all part of the evolving nature of threats to journalism, and certainly states are not doing enough, at least in a concrete way, beyond just statements. We need to see more action, including by our democracies, to ensure that their own house is in order with the domestic press freedom climate, and that includes ensuring that the online space is a safe and enabling environment for journalists to be able to do their jobs.
All right. Well, we have run out of time, so we're going to have to leave the conversation there today. Thanks so much to all of our guests, Rebecca Vincent, Romeo Kokriatsky, and Tim Squirrel. And thank you, too, for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. I'm Mohammed Jamjoum and the whole team here in Doha. Bye for now.